Good evening. My name is Chuck Lemieux, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Chuck.
I won't miss that. It's 7:45. 7:45. I don't do this for you. I do this for me because I know there's a dance at midnight or something you guys want to be ready for. So, it's a real pleasure to be back in Saskatoon. When I've had Richard's number in my computer, in the calendar of my computer for a long, long time, and I was thinking, God, I wonder if I made a mistake, because I talked to him the last time I was here, and I thought, well, maybe I put his number this far ahead in my computer, and then one day he gave me a phone call, and I knew I had the right thing, so I was ready to go. I'm glad to come back here. Excuse me. My grandpa immigrated from France with a Catholic wife and three children and came to Canada and settled in Quebec. He had five more kids with that lady, so there was eight of them in Canada. And then I have no clue what happened. I think we talked about this earlier today about don't talk, don't tell, don't ask, whatever, you know, the things were in. Don't share and don't trust and all that. I have no clue what happened, but he ended up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, married to a Norwegian woman, and had eight kids with her, and she was a Protestant. So my grandpa Lemieux, I never did meet the guy. I think he probably did himself in. I don't know. But back in those days, of course, families usually didn't all survive. So there was... some of the Catholic side of the family had passed on as they were kids, and my dad was a twin, and his brother, twin brother, died, and he had twin sisters, and one of them died. So, but what's interesting to me is that I have no clue about that background. I don't know what happened to those people, because the Protestants and the Catholics wouldn't discuss it. They were at war with each other, and I was down in Green Bay. When I was a kid, and we walked past this barber shop, and my dad says, "That's my half brother," because the Lemieux was on the side of the barber shop, and my aunt said, "We don't talk to them people," and we just kept on walking. I was taking a train one day, and my dad worked for the railroad, so he had an annual pass, and the conductor came through and asked for tickets. So I handed him my dad's pass, and he looked at it. He said, "Are you Lloyd's boy?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "He's my half-brother." So I talked with this guy for a while. But that's, you know, that's that don't talk and don't ask and don't trust and all that. It's just kind of just locked away someplace. But the reason I bring it up is because, to me, I've always thought Canada was this romantic place, you know, that... And we only live 150 miles from the border, but I always figured that it was this romantic place, and my grandpa came from Canada. And then I realized that my grandpa came from France and moved to Canada. And I say this with all sincerity. The first time that Sandy and I went to Canada, see, I just figured you were the poorer folk that lived north of us. And the first time I came to Canada, I fell in love. You people are so kind and so generous, and the country just has this kind of it's got this vigor and verve to it. To me, I just love being here. And we've traveled across Canada quite, from one end to the other. And I've always been favorably impressed with your country. And I have to say, I like Calgary a lot. I call it Calgary, but I guess you Canadian folk call it Calgary. Sounds kind of funny. Okay, I got to get going. I got thank yous. And I didn't have that spiel planned about my Catholic Protestant background. I got to thank Richard and Karen. They've been just wonderful. They invited us into their home. Their cats gave us fleas, and it was just a marvelous, marvelous thing. I sense their excitement and their fervor for the program of Al-Anon. It's just there. I can just tell. And the people that we've met in this past, since Thursday that we've been here, I went to an adult children's meeting. The last one I went to was probably 4 or 5 years ago. in Duluth, and there's not one there anymore. But I went to this adult children's meeting, and there was a lot of real sharing and caring. There was newcomers there. They had a newcomers meeting, and I think that's what Al-Anon's all about. And I certainly saw a lot of Al-Anon love being shared in that room Thursday night. Kristen and Jen, they're just super people. Sandy and I just fell in love with them. They laugh and they have fun, and they're just a joy to behold. And is there anything we can do? Is there anything we can do? We're not going home tomorrow, by the way. We decided to stay. Okay, that's that. That's that. I got her taken care of. I got him taken care of. Oh, the workshops. We didn't get to all the workshops, but I really appreciated that. Again, you could just tell that they were well prepared. The people knew what they were doing, and there was a lot of sharing from the heart going on in those workshops. And I certainly learned a lot. And to me, the way to a successful workshop is to get people involved and get feedback. And that certainly happened here this weekend. I can't say enough about that. I was born in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan in 1942. During the war, my folks moved into Superior because there's shipyards in Superior. Sandy kind of touched on what Superior is. Superior is a coal town, transportation, shipments of coal, iron ore, lumber, wheat from the plains of Saskatchewan, probably. A lot of stuff like that goes through Superior and Duluth. Ships from all over the world come that far. That's the end of the Great Lakes. We live right at the western tip of Lake Superior. They can't go any further. Trucks from the plains haul the grain. Railroads haul the grain into Twin Ports, along with coal from Montana, iron ore from up on the Iron Range of Minnesota. And it was a tough, hard town. When I was a kid, even later on, the Superior had the biggest census I remember, they had 35,000 people right after the war. And now there's about 27,000. There's 27,000 people in 89 bars. So you know what's going on in Superior. There was Sandy and I grew up on the wrong end of town. We grew up below the tracks. And it was a vibrant community. Hammond Avenue was the neighborhood point between the east side of the north end and the west side of the north end. I lived on the east side a couple blocks from Hammond Avenue. Sandy lived on the west side a couple blocks from Hammond Avenue. We never knew one another when we were kids, which was probably a fortunate thing. She probably would have beat the crap out of me. But I don't care what she says about being a pacifist. But anyway, I went to school with her sister. Her sister's only a couple weeks older than me. And it was a vibrant community. It was a lot of drinking, a lot of boozing. In my block, we lived in the middle of the block. And on one corner was a whorehouse called Hill's Rooms. And on the other corner was a whorehouse called Hermosa Hotel. And our house was in the middle. And I remember one night my mom, there was a knock on the front door, and we lived in this little one-story bungalow, two-bedroom place, and kind of like what Sandy was talking about, we were fortunate we had a built-in bathroom, but we didn't have hot water. And a little knock on the door, and I opened up my mom opened up the little window. She had one of the little square windows like this you might see in a speakeasy. She opened up that little window, and the guy says, "You got any girls for sale?" And my mom says what she would probably still say, "You SOB," and she slammed the door shut on him. And I was, what puzzled me was, why would anybody want to buy a woman? I couldn't figure that out. I thought everybody already had one. But that's where we lived. And as we discussed a little earlier today, my folks drank. I grew up in a house that was drinking. My dad and mom drank. The aunts and uncles drank. They would come from Michigan and stay at the house. They'd be laying all over the place, and there'd be cases of Northern beer consumed, and there was usually a few arguments thrown in there. On Friday nights, we would go to the bar. My dad got paid on Friday, and we would go to the bar. He'd cash his check, and mom would sit in the booth with the ladies. Dad would sit at the bar and talk railroad with the guys. And in Superior, Wisconsin, back up until the mid-60s, it was illegal for women to sit at the bar. I've never been able to figure that one out, but I suppose there was some kind of rational idea. I don't know. Maybe they saved places for the women of the evening. I have no clue what it was. But that's, you know, my brother and I drank Great Pop and ate chocolate bars and played pool, and my mom and dad drank. And I don't remember any particularly bad things happening. We had fun. We felt like we were part of the crew. The arguments that I remember happening in my house came from drinking. I know that. My life was affected by their drinking. I said earlier about when we would take trips that there would be a case of beer in the back of the, in the trunk of the car, and my dad would drink all the way to Ironwood. There was other instances as well, but I remember my brother and I, we were at a cabin just on the Michigan-Wisconsin border, and my mom and dad were drunk. And my brother and I were probably, I was probably 14, he's 6 years younger than me. And they were fighting, and I heard them talking about getting a divorce. My mom was saying, well, we get back to Superior, I'm leaving you. More words than that, but I'll leave those out. My mom is talks like a sailor. She's 94 and she still talks like a sailor. She talks like a 94-year-old sailor. But much louder now than it used to be as well. And she's a very interesting lady to take places. But they were arguing, and I remember at that age getting in between the two of them and saying, you don't give a damn about Jim or I. All you care about is yourselves. And that stopped the argument. And that's one of the few instances I remember getting involved in that that situation. So anyway, I grew up in a drinking home. The first television I ever saw was in a bar in Superior. We went to the bar to see the TV. And it was, the screen had to be at least this big. And we were all sitting around looking at this thing, and it was going, shh. And it was all snow. And I thought I saw something move. I thought I saw something move, you know. And I was at a bar. So a lot of my memories go back to my mom and dad's drinking and what we used to do in the bars. On the other hand, Sandy was born and raised in a house where it was an alcoholic home with no alcohol. And it was a totally insane place, as she shared earlier today. A lot of craziness went on inside that house. And that was the way the two of us grew up. She had five kids in the family, and I had my brother and I were the two kids. And we, as I said, did not know one another. I knew Sandy's brother, and I knew her sister because I went to school with her. The way I met Sandy's brother was he was going to get into a fight with somebody, and the guy says, if you're going to fight me, take that jacket off. And the guy took his jacket off. Dave dropped his jacket down to his elbows, and the guy cold-cocked him. You know, and that's probably the oldest trick in the book, but he fell for it. And I remember back then thinking, you deserve that. And now today, I wouldn't mind seeing him get cold-cocked again, huh? I hope he doesn't listen to this tape. He's a big guy. But I went to service when I was 17 years old. And I went over to France. I spent 2.5 years over in France, and then I got out in 64. And in Superior, in Wisconsin at that time, the drinking age was 21. I don't know what it's like here in Canada, but in Wisconsin, you could, if you had a beer bar and it was outside the city limits, you could sell beer to 18-year-olds. So consequently, a lot of 18-year-olds would drive out, what we call driving out into the county, and would drink at these 18-year-old bars. A lot of the kids aren't around today because they drive those. I grew up in the era of 426 Hemis and those great big Ford engines and the big Chevys. Muscle cars is what they were. And they'd go 120, 130 miles an hour, and you got an 18-year-old kid driving and drunk. Sandy was engaged to a guy that was a young guy, and they got into an argument, and she didn't go with him out in the colony, and he drove out with a couple other kids, three kids, hit head-on with another car, and a bunch of them died out there. And that's the way it was. That was a common occurrence in our part of Wisconsin. But anyway, I got out of the service. Yeah, I was 20 years old. And one night Dale called me up, my friend Dale, and said, "You want to go out in the county and have a beer?" And this was a Wednesday night, and I said, "Sure." So we went out to the county and went to Clara's Tavern and sat down and ordered a couple of beers. And I'm no virgin when it comes to alcohol. I drank a lot. As a matter of fact, a couple of years before Sandy and I met, I totaled my Buick. I had a Buick convertible, and I was out drinking, and I was coming back to town and hit an icy spot and rolled that convertible down an embankment. And you don't do well when you roll convertibles. I don't know how I lived. I honest to God don't know. I woke up outside the car. I had this big gash in the back of my head, and my arm and my leg was messed up pretty good. But I survived. And that was from drinking. If I wouldn't have been drinking, that wouldn't have happened. So it isn't only alcoholics that get into trouble with alcohol. But that didn't stop me. We're sitting out in that bar, Dale and I, and I didn't know it, but they had an ulterior motive for having me at that bar. Dale's girlfriend, Nancy, came in and to the bar, and walking behind her was this beautiful, beautiful woman. She was just, I saw Nancy, and then I saw her. And her and Nancy were walking in, and as she was coming closer, she had this, her hair stood up about 3 feet on her head, and she had this, it was frosted. She looked like a root beer float coming towards me, you know. And that's 1966, and you had hair this high. If it could get higher, you'd put it higher, but there's a law of physics somewhere there where you can only go so far. Yeah, yeah. You should see her graduation picture. It's sideways. It goes this way because her hair is that. Well, anyway, it was Sandy, by the way, and she's walking towards me, and she had a black sweater on that was filled to its maximum potential. I didn't know she called them assets at that time. I had another word for it, but I stutter when I get excited, so I, but look at those. Look at her. And I still remember that sweater and how it looked, and it was kind of stretched, actually. And her and Nancy are walking towards me, and I'm starting to sweat because I am a dork. I'm tall, I'm skinny, I've got Buddy Holly glasses and a Buddy Holly hairdo. And I see there's some people here approximately my age. Buddy Holly's hair would come right up at the top and then kind of combed over and then down. Ah, yeah. Sandy told me they could have landed an airplane on the top of my head. But anyway, I had these big, thick, black-rimmed glasses and this Buddy Holly hairdo that had a quart and a half of Brill Cream in it. And I just thought I was an idiot. You know, no girls ever found me sexy, if that was even a word back then. And here she comes. Here she comes. And I'm thinking, we could have 3 or 4 kids, and we could live in a little white house with a picket fence, and ooh, I wish she'd sit somewhere else. I hope they go somewhere else and sit. I hope she sits down. And she came over, and Nancy sat next to Dale, and Sandy plopped her butt right down next to my left leg. I had not had a lot of female thighs up against my leg. And here it was, hot, warm, toasty. And I was hot and warm and sweaty. And we got introduced, and she said, after we talked for a while, she said, "Chuck, what do you do for a living?" And I said, "I love my nose, yeah, yeah, yeah." And I thought, here you go again, you idiot. She's never going to go out with you. She's never going to think anything of you. You can't even talk, for God's sakes. And I couldn't remember. I had a real problem remembering her name because her name wasn't what I was interested in, but... And I fantasized a lot. I lived on fantasy for a long time. Right up there, that was probably the height of my fantasies was when she sat down next to me, and I didn't figure that we'd be together again. I just knew that she was too pretty and too vibrant and too beautiful, and she was, I didn't know it, but she was 18 years old and I was 22. She did something to me that night that I didn't, I remember it. She said she doesn't remember it. I think she lies. She took her toe and she put her toe on my ankle. I don't know if you've ever been toed on your ankle. This is 1966, friends. You didn't have all this graphic crap all over the airways. I lived on that for a long time. That was... I usually say there were several nocturnal emissions, but I won't bring that up tonight. But we double dated after that. That night, we hit us off. Sandy and I just kind of hit off together, and we were like the hand in the glove. We were like two sick people looking for one another, and we had found one another, and we started going out together, and we very quickly just kind of put our friends off to the side, and it was her and I. It was just us. We doubled a couple times, and then after that, we were just together. And we swore we weren't going to get serious. Now I hear from her story that she was putting her claws into me, so I don't know about that part. But I figured we weren't going to get serious. And hell, within 2 weeks, we went a lot further than not getting serious. About 9 months later, we were married. It was January 21st, 1967 that we got married. It was 38 below zero in Superior, and I'm sure that doesn't impress you people at all. I love telling that story when we're down south because you can just see everybody go, oh. But that was just another night, you know. So we did not know about alcoholism. We did not know about the problem of alcoholism. We certainly didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had never heard of Al-Anon. But I know that night, that 19-year-old girl, she had turned 19 and I was 23. I know that 19-year-old girl and that 23-year-old young man thought they were in love and were going to be happily ever after. We would live happily ever after. We went to the Moose Club. We had an accordion and a drummer. They were husband and wife. They were the Dizleskis, is what they were called. And they had a fancy name. She played the accordion, he played the drums, and that's all we could afford. They had a bandstand, by the way. They each had their little bandstand in front of them, you know. She got drunk and fell over hers. Sandy said she never missed a beat with that accordion. She just kept on playing. We had a pony keg of beer. That was all we could afford. And I wanted to go home I wanted to go home because now we didn't have to hide in some dark alley anymore. Sandy didn't have to look at the smokestack of the college. You know, she just, we were legal now. And I wanted to go home, and she wanted to drink some more of that damn pony keg. And I didn't want to, and I didn't understand that. And she didn't understand that. She thought I was a stick in the mud, and I thought I was just this tall, skinny dork that looked like Buddy Holly. And we loved one another, I guess. We certainly were in heat anyway. We were young kids, you know. Now, when I start talking about this, never mind. Sandy always does. She gives me a haircut. I just got a haircut a couple of days ago because she says, "You get up there and you rub your head like that." We're married. We're 19, we're 23, and Sandy comes from a background of an alcoholic home where the word love is never mentioned. I come from a home where a background where there's drinking, and love is talked about all the time. Love, 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 love. You know, I love you, I love you. I was really embarrassed. When I was 16 years old, my dad, I'd have guys over the house or something. We'd go to leave, my dad'd say, "I love you." I said, "Oh, Dad, I'm 16. You don't tell me you love me, you know." That's the background I had. So the two of us get married. How do you have a healthy relationship in a situation like that? Did I know what a healthy relationship was? I didn't even know what a relationship was. I had not used that word. That wasn't part of my vocabulary. Sandy certainly hadn't used that word. That wasn't part of her vocabulary. And here we are, two young kids with these totally divergent backgrounds together, making a family. We're starting up an alcoholic home, but we did not know that. There was problems, there was things going on, and we couldn't figure out what it was. There was just stuff just wasn't right. We drank a lot. We went to movies. Anything that we did, we had alcohol. If we went to a movie, we had a bottle of wine. We brought a bottle of wine into the movie because we tried beer can, but beer cans roll down the aisle and make noise. And when the two heroine and the hero are going to start swapping spit on the screen and you pop the top off of a Budweiser, that kind of ruins the thing right there. People turn and look, you know. So we brought wine. Well, we were going to go out to eat someplace. Or, you know, we were going to go to eat at a fancy restaurant, you know, probably pay $5 or $6 for a meal. And but we'd stop at the East End Tavern first for a beer before we went out to eat. And we'd end up having a Tombstone pizza because we sat at the bar and got drunk. And that's the way it was. Everything that we did had to do with alcohol. We did not know one another sober. We met in a bar. I heard that earlier this weekend. We met in a bar. But everybody met in a bar. We weren't different from everybody else. We just did what everybody else did. But things just didn't feel like they were going right. You know, I wanted to go home, and this lady wanted to drink. When you're dealing with, I didn't know this at the time. I just knew that she used to tick me off really easily. When you're dealing with an alcoholic, when you're dealing with a drunk, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. I learned that really quick. Here's the scenario. It's Friday night. We're going to go out. So we're going down Stinson Avenue, just a couple blocks from home. We're heading down towards East Fifth Street. And Sandy says, where do you want to go tonight? I don't care. Wherever you want to go. See, it didn't take me long to learn safe answers. I don't care. It's up to you. We'll go wherever you want to go. And she says to me, God, I'm so sick and tired of you. You can't make up your mind. It's always where I want to go. We always have to go where I want to go. I'm sick and tired of this. Can't you decide something? Well, that makes a guy feel really good. So the next Friday night, we're driving down Stinson Avenue, heading towards Fifth Street to go downtown. She says, Chuck, where do you want to go? I says, well, let's go to the Crowbar. You always want to go to the Crowbar. Isn't there anything else you want to do? You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. And that's kind of the way it went. And we never suspected anything was wrong other than that we had this volatile relationship, and drinking was part of our life, and we didn't consider that to be wrong. Sandy had my first baby when 9 months after we were married. She had our son Chuck, and almost 13 months after that, she had our daughter Chrissy. And 3 years after that, she had our youngest and last son Kurt, and beautiful, beautiful kids. And what I'm going to share with you right now, if I bring up stuff about Sandy's drinking, or if I bring up stuff about her alcoholism, I'm not trying to tell her story. She did a fine job this afternoon doing that. What I want to share with you is my insanity, the insanity of a non-alcoholic, how crazy you can be with the family disease. You suffer from the disease of alcoholism, and you don't have it because it makes you insane. But, you know, Sandy mentioned earlier she's got a couple of chronic illnesses, and I'm affected by those chronic illnesses. She's got lupus, and I get affected by that. I have a concern for her, and I worry about her. And I remember when she was first diagnosed, and we just cried because we figured it was the end of the world. We looked it up in a dictionary because we didn't know what it meant, and it said a fatal illness. That was it. That was the whole definition, a fatal illness. And we just came apart. And she went into a situation where she was doctoring for it, and she was being medicated for it, and she's doing fine. She goes into flare-ups, but she's dealing with it. But I'm affected by it because I have a concern for her, because I love her. She's got some other stuff going on, too, and it's the same way there. I'm affected. I'm not going to get into it, but she's had medical problems, and I've always been affected by it. Would I not be affected by her alcoholism? Certainly I would be. It's an illness. It's a disease, and I'm affected by it. Sandy had Chuck, our oldest son. And 13 months later, she had Chris, our daughter. And we're living in this little building, little two-bedroom house, and It was really tiny. It was almost like a dollhouse, you know. And we had the two cribs upstairs in the bedroom next to us. And Sandy turned 21 years old somewhere in there, and she started drinking downtown with this woman that made her drink. We got a lot of Al-Anon people in here, and you know that the alcoholic in your life wouldn't have drank unless it was for somebody else. They were forced to drink by somebody else. And this is what I truly believed. And Sandy would go drinking with this woman, and I would be home alone with those two kids. And one particular night, I'm going to share with you what went on. I'm sitting at home alone with those kids, and Sandy, I know she's with this lady, and they're drinking at this lady's apartment, and I'm mad. You look at me today, I'm probably 30 pounds lighter at least than I was then, and I have a whole lot less hair than I had then, and I had a face full of hair. And I was mean. I have very intimidating eyes, and people were afraid of me. I'm sitting at home, and I'm feeling totally impotent about this situation. There's nothing I can do about it. And I started thinking, the kids are both in bed, because Chucky was one, Chrissy was newborn. They're both in bed. They're both sleeping. I can take the car, and I can go get that woman, because I know where she is. She's at so-and-so's house in that apartment. So I jumped in the car, and I went down there to get her. I jumped in the car, and I started up, and down the road I went, and I drove to that house where I knew she was, and sure enough, the lights were on in the second-floor apartment. The shades were down. You could see movement back and forth. I'm going to go up there, and I'm going to kick some ass. I really am. And I'm going to go up there, and I'm going to take her by her long brunette hair, and I'm going to drag her down those stairs, and I'm going to show her who's boss. And I might show a few of those guys that are up there who's boss, too, as long as I'm at it. And I sat in that car, and I'm getting really steamed. And I sat in that car, and I sat in that car, and I started that car up, and I drove home. Who's nuts? The alcoholic who's sitting up there drinking, having a party with some friends, or the stark raving sober non-alcoholic who left his two little babies home alone in February in Superior, where it gets cold like it gets cold here. And there, every year there are house fires where people die because of the improper furnaces. Who's crazy, the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic? I think I was nuts for